ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Do you think you'd never be caught out by disinformation? Well, cast your mind back. Remember that big story about the bedbugs at the Paris Olympics? Well, that was actually a very effective Russian disinformation campaign. So effective that most people still believe it to this day. G'day, it's Hamish McDonald here. And I've learned that disinformation can be surprisingly subtle and hard to spot. If you want to join me interrogating the dark world of disinformation, stream The Matter of Facts now on ABC iView.
You know, in the current context, just hearing the last few notes of that sting, the minefield theme, the dissonance at the top, never thought this before, but it just summarises how we all seem to be feeling right now. Welcome to the minefield as we grit our teeth and try to get through the modern world. I'm just going to say that's the tagline of the show now. Waleed Ali is my name. Scott Stephens is my co-host. Hello, Scott.
Hey, Waleed. That was perfect.
Was it? It doesn't feel perfect, Scott. Yeah. It's one of these moments, isn't it? We're in this weird moment for this particular episode because we did, in the very immediate aftermath of the Ramadan series, we did a show that was about the war in Iran, and we spoke about how, well, it would be kind of missing the whole moral point to be talking about, you know, the effect of the war on fuel prices and cost of living and so on and so forth. And then more or less as soon as, I think it was you that made that point.
Yes, it was.
I don't disagree with it, by the way. But as soon as you uttered those words into the microphone, it feels like we've spoken about almost nothing else as a nation.
I mean, in fairness, just to clarify, I don't think I said that these things are inconsequential. They simply don't matter. But to raise them to, if you like, the headline issue, to say that this is the most consequential thing that's going on with the war, I thought what would be an act of kind of moral delinquency.
Yeah, and I think that's probably right. But then you inspect the headlines, Scott. It turns out that is the headline thing that's going on with the war, at least as far as local news is concerned. I don't say that as any kind of judgment, by the way. I think there is a thing that transpires in the face of global upheaval and just catastrophic events that are happening wherever they happen around the world. And that is, I think in some ways, a pragmatic judgment that people reach, which is, well, yes, that's all terrible, but ultimately, there's nothing I can do about it. Mm-hmm. And so if it's beyond my, what is it, sphere of influence? Is that that's the jargon from about 20 years ago, whatever?
That's right.
Then I can be concerned, but ultimately, there are other things that deserve my energies because I can affect them. It's a fairly sort of pragmatic, perhaps non-idealistic judgment, but I do think occasionally there is something to commend it. I wouldn't say it should be the default or perpetual state of human beings, but there is something there, and it particularly is a streak that runs through the Australian spirit, I think, where it's kind of like, well, yeah, but what am I going to do?
And look, it's not even just recent jargon. I mean, this is fundamentally the Stoic disposition, that one's primary sphere of moral concern is what Marcus Aurelius called the inner citadel, the integrity of one's own inner life. And then the extent to which we do worry about the world, we ought to engage in the world in those forms of life where our actions, our concerns, our wringing of hands can in fact have some sort of difference. Look, I mean, this is very much the product, though, of the media age, that the extent of our action and concern has been decoupled from the sources of emotional and moral agitation, so that we become concerned about more things than we can really be able to respond to in any kind of effective way.
I would
way.
Go further than that.
Yep.
We are flooded by things we cannot affect.
That's right.
And that creates within us just a torturous anxiety, because one of the great sources of really deep insecurity is this rupture between what concerns you and what you can affect.
Yeah. Let's just bump that even further, though, that there's an obligation to feel that goes along with being flooded with these different sources of concern.
When you say obligation, are you referring to something that exists in moral reality, or are you referring to something that exists at the level of social expectation?
That's precisely the point. It's now part of our socio-moral ecosystem. That
within subcultures, I would say, because I do think there is also a prevailing mainstream approach, which is reflected through mainstream politics, mainstream media.
The pragmatic
which
shrug.
Is far less concerned with that.
Yeah, that's right. And then something that really does concern others drastically, dramatically, existentially overseas begins to hit home. And you have that convergence of the over there and the concern and the obligation to feel and the sheer pragmatic reality of this is what that is now costing me. And it's precisely that convergence we've been seeing now for about 3.5 weeks. Although it is interesting to note, just kind of going back a little bit to make sure I got the timeline right here. The first reports of angry altercations at petrol stations, the first reports of people not just rushing to filling up their car, but also filling up anywhere from 6 to 10 jerry cans of petrol to boot. The earliest reports were from about March the 3rd. So we think about
5 days from the beginning of the war?
Within 5 days, as soon as there was the inkling that fuel shortages might be on their way, or at very least there was going to be a spike in fuel costs, something really interesting began to click into place. We saw it at the opening stages of the pandemic, didn't we? We saw it back.
And by the way, the proximity to that, I think, is a major part of
it. It really is, isn't it? I mean, you're right. We are still living in so many respects with the kind of moral or the sociological hangover of those early days of the pandemic and then the fear of a repeat in state and federal government action. It's been so interesting, hasn't it, over the last 2 weeks in particular. We've seen sides of politics, all sides of politics, condemning, warning, or ruling out heavy-handed government action. Forms of mandated restriction. We've seen the language of rationing, Waleed, begin to assert itself on the public imagination and begin to haunt the edges of political discourse. And the effect that that's having on us, the chill that it's sending down the collective spine, I'm finding really concerning. It concerns me about what it says about our present moment, about what it says about our political health. Does this mean that liberal democracy is just fine, that social cohesion is okay in times of overarching prosperity, but as soon as things begin to get a bit tight, as soon as forms of scarcity begin to assert themselves, as soon as shortages and, God forbid, rationing begins to come into view, does that mean that we all become self-interested or self-preserving populists?
So let's stop on that point.
Yeah, please.
I want you to unpack that. What are the signs that that would be the case?
The signs would be as soon as a moment that requires a degree of collective action comes into view, rather than reaching towards one another in gestures of mutual trust, I'm going to take for granted here that you're not going to screw me over.
I mean, by what? Filling up? By hoarding petrol.
By hoarding petrol, by using more petrol than you need. Let me put it a slightly different way. That moment at which a kind of baked-in distrust, let's call it a vertical distrust, in the ability of government to look after our interests and to treat us all equitably in a manner that's going to assist everyone as much as possible without that assistance accruing unnaturally or illegitimately or unjustly at certain parts of the social spectrum. The moment at which that vertical distrust in government is then translated or transposed onto a horizontal axis, where a prevailing condition of political distrust becomes a prevailing condition of mutual or social distrust, where I can't trust you to do the right thing, therefore, A, I'm going to get in first and make sure that I can get what I need before stocks begin to run low. And B, as long as I escape, as long as it doesn't happen to me, that's okay. I think on both levels, those are the forms of, protecting oneself or being ab initio suspicious of government And this is part of the COVID hangover. I think you're right. Yep. But then translating that onto mutual, so call it democratic suspicion. Suspicion of one's neighbors, no longer as neighbors, but as competitors, no longer as citizens, but as threats. It's at that moment that I think when that transposition takes place, that's what raises the concerns for me, that we are fine to be good liberal Democrats when we have everything we need and when scarcity isn't in view, when rations aren't being spoken about. But as soon as they are, as soon as there is in fact a collective problem that needs to be addressed to some extent collectively, then we turn our backs on one another. That, for me, is really concerning.
Okay. You've put me in a very awkward position because I agree with that observation about liberal democracy. I do think, and I think the signs have been there for some time, even though I would probably struggle to make them concrete. But I think it's been observable for some time that once prosperity goes, we really fracture. We panic.
Our values evaporate? Is it fair to say that what we profess to be our values begin to evaporate?
I think that's what I mean.
Okay.
Yeah. We look for scapegoats amongst ourselves, these sorts of things. I think that's true. We can expand upon that theoretically, if you like, throughout the show. I don't know that I agree, though, that people buying up lots of petrol at the onset of the war is an example of that.
Hmm.
I don't read the signs, that particular sign, in the way that you read it, or at least I think you read it, for two reasons. One is, I don't think people buying up petrol was an anxiety about petrol running out so much as about petrol becoming extremely expensive.
Sure.
In other words, I heard someone from the oil industry make this point, and I actually think they were right. It was probably not right to talk about it as panic buying so much as forward buying.
Mm-hmm.
Petrol right now is, let's call it $1.90 a litre. It might have even been $1.60 at the start of the war, something like that. I know it's going to soar. Within a week, it'll be $2.50, maybe more. Maybe it'll get to $4 at some point. In other words, this is just a way of avoiding the price rise. And maybe I wasn't thinking about whether we would run out of fuel or whether this surge in demand would create problems and cause bowsers to go dry. So maybe I just wasn't thinking about that. I was just thinking about the cost curve. But actually, if you were someone who, it will say you were a farmer, so this was a really big problem in rural areas.
Yeah, it was.
Partly because of a distribution challenge and getting, it wasn't so much the amount of oil, but just getting it distributed to the places to meet the demand that had surged. But if you were a farmer or something, actually your requirement to get lots of fuel and to get it at the cheapest price that you possibly can for the foreseeable future, it might be individually motivated or selfishly motivated. It might be an act of desperation given True. The really tight margins that a lot of farmers are on in the first place. But it could also be construed as an altruistic act. I mean, these are people providing us with food. And if they can't function, then the knock-on effects throughout our society are potentially catastrophic. So I think there's a bit more in it than that.
Agreed.
Where I do think things become interesting is in, for example, the Albanese government's decision to halve the fuel excise.
Okay. Yeah.
So this was a demand that the opposition made. It's been done before. I think John Howard did it at certain times. Scott Morrison certainly did it. At the onset of a cost of living crisis towards the end of his term.
2022, the last oil shock.
Right, and it was late enough in his term that it expired on the Labor government's watch, and there was all sorts of pressure for them to keep that discount going, and they chose to let it lapse and so on. Now the Labor government has chosen to institute the same thing. Economists seem agreed this is a really bad idea, that it creates... It messes with all sorts of important price signals, that it's going to fuel inflation, which will be with us then for even longer, that it's going to create all kinds of shocks when eventually that excise is added back and so on. So if you were looking at this from a perspective that was economically informed, at least according to the consensus of most economists, and was not concerned with people's individual circumstances as, you know, a matter of immediate hip pocket concerns, you would say this is irresponsible policy and that the appropriate thing for us to do is find other ways of helping people who really are on the edge, but not ultimately capitulate to people's self-interested concerns and demands in the moment. And yet it is abundantly clear that the Albanese government really had no... Can you imagine them refusing?
That's exactly right.
Maybe that's a sign. I do, by the way, have certain concerns. I'd place certain caveats even on that analysis I've just articulated there. Mm-hmm. I think there is something about the sort of price inelasticity of fuel that is interesting. I think the fact that it came following a national cabinet meeting that had some, not all, states slashing or even making free public transport that is designed to take demand out of the fuel system and that might actually work in doing that. There is something there that makes me think maybe the economic story isn't quite that straightforward. And I know that Anthony Albanese has made that point that, well, actually, yes, this will reduce the cost of fuel compared to what it otherwise would be, but that's in a context where the cost of fuel is skyrocketing anyway. And so people are already being smashed. The impact on inflation, I guess you could say it's arguable because it's going to reduce the price, which means that the inflation indicator will be slightly down. And also, arguably, the surge in the cost of fuel has done the work of what an interest rate hike would do anyway, because it's taking money out of people's pockets and so on and so forth. We can end up in an economic conversation that, frankly, is not the forum for that. And you'd have different people having that conversation than us, I presume. So I do think it's complicated. But if you are looking for indicators that self-interest trumps altruistic or collective interest in a moment like this, I'd probably start more there than I would in the forward purchasing of fuel. I don't know if that convinces you at all, but...
I just think
it's a very complicated story in a way that the panic buying of toilet paper at the onset of the pandemic kind of wasn't. I think that was different in all sorts of ways.
I think you're right. One of the things I should have been more cautious about doing, and I'm very glad you did it, is to leave, let's call them primary providers or primary services, out of this particular equation. All too often when we say we, or when we say people, or when we say Australians, what we really are doing is referring to people who live in urban areas rather than rural providers, farmers, and so on, for whom there is very, very little that is discretionary or self-interested about this. So, I mean, that particular point, I think, is vitally, vitally important.
Or at the very least, where self-interest overlaps almost totally coextensively with the public.
That's exactly right. So there's nothing really discretionary about that I think can be criticized. I think what is sort of interesting here, though, is, and I take your point entirely about instead of kind of stockpiling or hoarding, it really was more forward buying fuel while it was still cheap. I'm not sure. I mean, on one level, that's evidently correct. It was remarkable, though, just how quickly fuel prices began to rise. It may well have been, I mean, within 5-6 days, things had still already surpassed, what, $2.30, $2.40. So maybe there was a kind of vicious circle that had already begun to set in place, where on the one hand, the very act of hoarding or forward purchasing, however you want to characterize it, that then provided perverse incentives to petrol stations, how can we refer to this generally?
Price gouging, which the ACCC is looking into.
Thank you. Which then created the further sense, my God, things are all happening much quicker than I thought. What is going to be the ceiling? Hence, even more advanced purchasing, more hoarding, which then created this strange kind of social phenomenology that even if the number of petrol stations that were running out of fuel really were quite limited, even if the number of tags, pump not in use, that were being seen around the place in the real world, in physical reality, were themselves rather limited, every time drivers saw one, those appearances were, if you like, phenomenologically overdetermined. That then mapped onto the flurry of images, the range of reporting, the footage that was already being seen that there were fuel shortages elsewhere. And therefore, every time I saw one close to me or near a station that I was driving past, it then became a signifier of a general sense of broader scarcity, of greater shortages than may themselves even exist, which then has the kind of compounding effect. I've got to get it. I've got to get in before things run out or become dire.
So, and against a background, by the way, of a government whose initial response was to be quite quite dismissive of the possibility of fuel shortages, and then slowly sort of change its tune, which then feeds back into your concern about distrust of government.
Yes. And that, I think, is why the halving of the fuel excise, I'm so glad you underwrote the complexity of it. I mean, one of the things that an increase in price is meant to do is to encourage a degree of self-rationing, if I can just put it that simple way.
Yeah.
When things become more expensive, you're supposed to get less of it. And then those who there's a premium on having access to that fuel, they're supposed to be able to buy more. So that's supposed to have a kind of restraining effect.
It's the invisible hand.
It's the invisible hand. Yeah. Thank you. And I think what's interesting is that those prices seemingly did not have that effect on voluntary self-rationing.
Well, indeed, those prices were a consequence of the opposite.
Exactly. Which means then that the halving of the excise could then have a perverse effect on encouraging the very behavior that the price increases themselves are meant to manage, which then creates the greater issue of the possibility of shortages down the road and so on. And yet, Waleed, you're absolutely right. For the government not to do anything, that would have been regarded. And I don't think we need to even think about this in terms of kind of political snookering, the fact that the Liberal Party raised the prospect, raised the idea. It's not even that the government was simply then forced to do it. It's that had it not acted, even in this kind of, I mean, you don't want to say it's a symbolic thing because it really will help people. There really will be an effect on lowering the total bill of a full tank of petrol. But to ignore that particular option would have been received by the public as such a perfidious form of political betrayal. An act of, so, you know, I mean, this is one of the things that I think has been a central part of political theory, really, for the last 50 years. When does misfortune come to be experienced by a population as injustice? When misfortune is viewed, is seen, is not responded to, is treated with a degree of disdain or disregard. It's at that point that something that is misfortunate becomes to be experienced as an act of political betrayal. And had the government not done anything, I can really see that fundamental disposition of distrust really being doubled down upon. So, I mean, it was necessary for the government to do what it did, almost as an act of public assurance.
So just as the skyrocketing price is a price signal, what the government was doing was sending a solidarity signal.
Okay.
I would think of it that way. Because at a time of crisis, people need a sense that those who are leading them are somehow on their team.
Yes.
And we also understand, and I think the polling is bearing this out, so far the Australian population understands there's actually not that much that our government can do.
That's right.
But it can send these signals and it can do what it can do, at the very least. And if it doesn't do what it can do, well, that sends out a very different sort of signal that I don't think can be reduced merely to populism.
No, that's exactly right. But then there's also the possibility of a further effect. And I think we should probably leave it here and bring in the guest. You know, one of the U.S. presidents in living memory that I'll confess I continue to have a degree of fondness for is Jimmy Carter. The final catastrophic year of his presidency was 1979, that coincided with not just the Iran hostage crisis, but also a crippling oil shock. And in 1979, he engaged in a fabulously, famously, infamously disastrous form of democratic virtuous education, where he addressed the nation in what's now referred to as the crisis of confidence speech, where he effectively said two things. The government is doing everything that it can to try to reduce its dependency on oil from the Middle East. And at the same time, as an act of social solidarity, as an act indeed of patriotism, there is something that Americans can do to look after one another and to reduce our collective dependence on this form of volatile energy. And he just suggested very, very simple things. Maybe take the car less one day a week. Maybe try to carpool. Maybe reduce your energy consumption instead of just relying on or assuming that this degree of availability of forms of fuel is going to remain there. Maybe just engage in a little bit of democratic or collective or social self-restraint. And the effect, Willie, the popular effect, the electoral effect, was catastrophic. He almost certainly would have been voted out anyway because of all sorts of geopolitical issues. But in many respects, in terms of the domestic climate, it was that appeal to voluntary self-rationing that was decisive. And I do think if the prime minister turned to the nation, as in fact he did during his nationally televised address, and urged them to engage in just a little bit of self-restraint, yes, go about your lives, but don't use more fuel than you need to. Consider taking public transport instead of hopping in the car to get to work. You can imagine if the prime minister did that without having exhausted certain mechanisms that were available, that were at the government's own disposal, like, for instance, having the fuel excise. You can just imagine that the electorate themselves would have taken that as a form of government betrayal. You're asking us to do our share. Why don't you meet us halfway?
Which is where the patchwork might become a bit tricky, because I think making public transport free or very cheap, for example, would be a powerful signifier in that regard as well. But that's a state matter. Hmm. And then the states have different responses.
As is, as just is the state's response to the GST.
All right. Now we're going down a rabbit hole. Perhaps we should stop. Stop going down the rabbit hole and bring in a guest, shall we? You are listening to The Minefield on ABC Radio National, where we, what did I say, grit our teeth and try to get through it, I think. Willie Darley is my name. Scott Stevens, my co-host. Now we have a guest.
Our guest is Melanie White. She's Professor of Sociology in the School of Social Sciences at the University of New South Wales. Melanie, thank you for joining us once again on The Minefield.
Thank you so much for having me. I've been really enjoying listening to the conversation. One of the things that occurred to me is that there's a great sociological question to be asked in relation to this. And I'm thinking here of the North American sociologist Irving Goffman, who says, what's happening here? That's the great sociological question. And I think on the one hand, the petrol discussion is a bit of a question about, you know, what is it a symptom of? And there are so many different ways to read this symptomatic issue. And it occurred to me listening to you, Waleed, on the reality of rational anticipatory purchases for a future, and contrasted with Scott, your emphasis on the symbolism associated with images of the fuel out sticker on the Bowsers. And it struck me that I think petrol is perhaps one of these moments of a broader symbolic experience about the interrelation of a number of different things, one being the reality of energy crisis and the reality of that leading both as a consequence of a broader international security issue, but also personal ontological security about how and what we need to feel secure in the world. And so there are those kind of three anchors that mediate this issue of what is the reality of the petrol crisis? Are the prices going to go higher? Is it just simply a media frenzy on creating kind of a visceral, phenomenological, moral panic? Or is it actually a consequence of real time issues with respect to international security and otherwise? So I guess back to the question, what's going on here, is that it is so very complicated in terms of thinking about what choices, what conditions of possibility any given person is faced with when they pull up to a Bowser to fill up their car. It's in some ways not just simply about the immediacy of this moment and filling this tank of gas, but it also is situated in a broader fabric of a whole series of symbolic relations about, you know, our energy security, our international security, and our own sort of personal sense of security.
Can I ask the two of you something? I don't want this to be, okay, you know, take something pragmatic and turn it spooky. But, you know, Waleed mentioned earlier the COVID hangover. And one of the enduring effects of the COVID hangover was the fear of a loss of agency, especially in places like Melbourne, to some extent Sydney, but especially places like Melbourne. That really was the sense of powerlessness, the inability to direct oneself, one's own life, for seemingly interminable periods during lockdown. And then you couple that COVID hangover with, let's call it, the symbolism of fuel itself, that in many respects, fuel, petrol, is a kind of representation of one's desire to one's ability to direct one's life. It is, if you like, a kind of public or cultural instantiation of agency itself. It is the means by which we do what we want, go where we want, direct our own lives. Are you suggesting, Melanie, do you think, Waleed, that what we're seeing here at a very deep level is the kind of convergence of, on the one hand, the fear of the loss of agency some 5-6 years ago, and at the same time, this signifier of, this symbol of our desire for self-directedness, for self-agency, now seemingly under threat?
I think that it's very possible. But on the other hand, I think part of me is thinking about just a general sense in which our shared sensibilities about how we approach these events as individuals, as families, as coworkers, etc., are being disrupted. And most immediately, we have the COVID experience as demonstrating a particular kind of behavior, a panic that was disarticulated from a certain kind of reality. Was it really the case that we needed to stockpile toilet paper in order to feel secure? It reflects the sense in which perception is so important in this. In the COVID context, the perception, it wasn't about toilet paper per se, it was about the feeling of being secure, and that panic buying toilet paper permitted that sense of security, a sense of agency that you could do something in the face of a broader context of a pandemic in which one couldn't predict the outcome. I think the question about whether or not that particular motivation applies to the motivation here about petrol is an interesting one. I'm not sure it does, because I think that the question is about, there is still a certain kind of rationality associated with the purchase of petrol. And I think you're absolutely right. Petrol gives you energy, the capacity to move, etc., to demonstrate autonomy. And I think that the timeline is maybe a bit different in terms of the fact that an energy crisis is something that we have known for a long, long time might and will eventually come to pass. I think that it's a question for many of us, is this the moment that we've been waiting a lifetime for? Is this the moment of the energy crisis when, things become real, so to speak? So I do think that both examples reflect the challenge to a feeling of personal security and autonomy, and the feeling of a constraint upon action. But I do think that the psychology perhaps behind them is slightly different.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. it kind of is. I really think what the question you ask, or the analysis behind it, Scott, is really elegantly put. I just think there is something about the concrete consequences of access to fuel that mean it's a bit too neat for the circumstances. But I think about this more, not so much about autonomy, or maybe it's just the flip side of the same coin, but around the notion, which we've discussed on the show before, of precarity. Hmm. And I think it's why you see visceral reactions on things like housing, and we've seen that for a long time. What a fuel crisis like this does, especially when it is a direct, observable consequence of the actions of a foreign president and a foreign prime minister, is that it brings home just how deeply missing agency is in your life, just how deep your dependencies are on things. And I think it is mind-blowing for people to stop and really think about something they may have kind of known, but that so much of what makes their lives work relies on a tiny stretch of water.
Mm. It's tenuous.
Yeah. And the thing about modern life is, because it's so complex and because we live lives that are so defined by convenience and demands being met, we've constructed this edifice that makes our dependencies look invisible, become invisible to us. So when they suddenly become visible, it is a deep psychological shock. Now, can I use that observation to return us to the question that we kind of had at the beginning, which we haven't really actually gone back to, which is about social fragility in the absence of prosperity? I do believe this is a problem for liberal democracies on the basis of conversations we've had over many years now on this show, where the nature of liberal democracy is that it hollows out areas of consensus, solidarity, sacrifice, and it replaces them with notions of competitiveness, self-interest, and that somehow a public good such as it exists will be served through that means, but not through any kind of, you know, affirmation of something that is immaterial, but thick and binding. And so in the absence of that, once the prosperity element of it disappears, well, the pact has been violated in a certain sense. And there aren't those cultural, social, solidaristic, even spiritual resources to draw on that allow for notions of sacrifice for each other and for some greater good to trump notions of self-interest, comfort, whatever one's needs being met in a world where needs are defined in ever-expanding ways. So that is one element of it. But I do think this element of deep insecurity is a huge part of the problem because, okay, I've just said we lack some of these solidaristic resources that we might have in other circumstances been able to fall back on. That provided a sense of security. But we have also something very strange about our modern condition, which is that we are simultaneously enriched beyond the imaginations of our predecessors and precarious when it comes to the very fundamentals of our lives. I'm pretty sure I've made this point before, but that it is extraordinary to think that we can have meals turn up at our door mere moments after the thought has crystallized in our mind, but not be secure in our dwellings, or just in the fact that we have access to our dwellings. In pre-modern society, you didn't have to be wealthy to have a dwelling. It just meant you didn't have much else, perhaps. You didn't have easy access to food or entertainment that you could pay for, even, presuming it even existed. Or, in other words, the adornments of life were out of your reach, but the fundaments were there. We're now in a world where the adornments seem closer to us than the fundaments. And so where the fundaments become threatened in an instant because of this precarity that has been invisible to us before. I don't know. I was going to say it's only rational that we lose our minds, but I'm not sure that sentence makes literal sense. But you see what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. I found myself really nodding with in agreement there. I think that, you know, part of this question about our ontological insecurity is in fact born by the extent to which we've lost that historical imagination and, you know, the sense of being able to see and appreciate aspects of the conditions of our existence, like, magicking a meal, and suddenly here it is right before us. It's an extraordinary time to live in. And yet the ways of thinking that we have utilized to get to this point, spiritually speaking, I think, are somehow misaligned with our capacity to appreciate the convenience. We have an expectation of convenience, in other words, but then are really fundamentally challenged when convenience and autonomy no longer are realized by each of us us in that way. And I think maybe that this, just thinking back to some of the opening observations about the nature of obligation, that we no longer necessarily feel obligation in terms of a duty to one another, but it is an obligation that is somehow misdirected in a certain way. Thinking about sociological referent points, Emil Durkheim came up with the idea of anomie, and actually, he ended up taking it from another thinker, but that's for another time. Anyway, he came up with the idea of anomie to distinguish between, on the one hand, the feeling of expectations where we've lost that kind of normative sense of shared solidarity, and that is overladen by a feeling of genuine normlessness. And it might be one of those moments where this kind of concept reveals something about the contemporary moment, where we have a degree of a normlessness in terms of organizing our social obligations to one another in a deep, mutual, reinforcing, productive kind of way.
You're listening to The Mindfield on ABC Radio National. Waleed Ali, my name. The voice you just heard belongs to Melanie White, Professor of Sociology at the University of New South Wales, my co-host. And here he is Scott Stevens.
Thanks, Waleed. Look, I think the way that the two of you have been framing this is so vitally, vitally important. And it really throws us back, I think, on the question, what are periods of prosperity for? What is the overarching experience of convenience? In other words, not simply living in a manner that is hand-to-mouth. What is that experience of having more than enough, more than one absolutely needs? What are experiences of relative social peace? What are those periods for? And I think in many respects, that maps quite nicely onto one of the questions that motivated John Rawls, especially in the final portion of his book, A Theory of Justice, which is also, what does the experience of justice do? What is the experience of justice at a social level for? And I think in many respects, part of our response is during periods of peace and prosperity and convenience is to engage in long periods of thoughtlessness, of non-reflectiveness on how it is that we are able to live the way we do, but also what happens when the conditions or when the institutions of justice, as Rawls would put it, when the institutions of justice begin to fall into a condition of disrepair. In other words, during times of prosperity, we don't reflect on and we certainly don't build up those social or moral or virtuous muscles that would enable us to withstand and stand together in the face of those periods of precarity or scarcity or of shortages. And I guess my serious concern is, you know, we've assumed that liberal democracy is most essentially for self-determination and self-direction. Whereas if part of the underlying ethos of liberal democracy is giving us the wherewithal and giving us then the social and the economic opportunities for developing the muscles for self-restraint, for mutual consideration, for mutual attentiveness, as Rawls would put it, developing in ourselves the disposition where we come to bear one another's burdens, where we become willing to share one another's fate. If we don't cultivate those in times of prosperity, then we come upon periods of shortage, of scarcity, when the reality of the precarity of our existence really asserts itself, and then the lack of that, that underlying democratic moral formation, that underlying lack of spiritual formation even, begins to assert itself, and we end up in positions like we are now.
I think that one of the issues is that, you know, we tend to be fair weather, don't we? When times are good, let's make hay while the sun shines. And when times are bad, we lose our minds. And I think that, you know, in such a context, I think the loss of oneself is partly a function of a loss of an attunement with others, that we can perhaps appreciate that others are going through the same or similar, or experiencing the world in a fractured, disjointed, depressing, frightening, etc. way. And yet it's a question about what matters here. Is what matters me? Or is it what matters is a shared responsibility about tending to the people around us, to ensuring their well-being and productivity, leaning on them as they lean on us. And so this kind of way of being in the world, I think, is a function of that kind of attunement, which seems aligned with Rawls, you know, bearing the other's burden. But I think sometimes we just don't know how to do that, partly in a context where generationally, if I think about it, our time of prosperity has been relatively long. Mm. We've had three relative generations of prosperousness. So
that's the problem though, Melanie.
Yeah, mm. yeah. And I think that we've lost at that sense of being able to what it takes or investigate what it might mean to work with one another again. I don't know if that's what you meant by the problem. And if not, baton over to you.
No.
The problem I see is that human beings can't operate with a limitless we. Mm-hmm. We do need boundaries in order for the we to make any sense to us. Hence the thing I've quoted on this show, though not for many years actually, but many times from Ulrich Beck, that the way to get world peace is to declare war on Mars, right? There needs to be a border somewhere, something like that. The struggle we have is it's getting harder and harder to define that we such that we can imagine or allow ourselves to care about the impact this might have on another. I mean, let me give you an example that is quite different, but in some ways makes the point for that reason. I remember when COVID struck and lockdowns became a reality, and especially in places that had elongated lockdowns, Melbourne being the most obvious example, where the thing that was so horrible about it was not knowing, not having an end date. Hmm. So if I told you, look, it's going to be 3 months. Okay, it's hard. But, you know, there's a collective countdown. There would probably be a bit of fun about that element of it, if not many other elements. And it would be like a build-up to a huge celebration, right? And then I immediately thought of all those years where we saw asylum seekers in detention, especially offshore, but actually not entirely offshore, where they did all sorts of things that just looked incomprehensible to those of us in the Australian public who were just gazing upon it casually, you know, they're sewing up their lips. There was self-immolation going on. There were all these sorts of things going on. And you would hear psychologists talk about how, well, the real torture here is, yes, there's confinement, but there's the indefinite nature of it, that it goes on for years and years and years, and there is no end date and just no certainty as to how the process is even going. Just nothing. It's just a void. And I remember thinking, surely we'll make that connection. Like, surely at least some of us will make that connection. Almost no one. I don't remember hearing anyone talk about it, really. And what's that? Well, they're just not part of the we. They're not to be considered in that light. Now, you might say, well, asylum seekers are a different case. They're non-citizens. They're behaving in conduct that we as a nation have decided we don't like because it's irregular migration, it's queue jumping, whatever. You know, populate that as you wish. So you could argue that. But the question that then follows is, well, what exactly is the we? Because we also saw in COVID that the we wasn't confined or defined by citizenship. If you were an Australian citizen who was overseas, that was irrelevant. You were not part of the us. That meant that you could exercise the most fundamental rights of citizenship to enter your own country, et cetera, et cetera. So the resource that has been, lots of resources have been lost here. But it seems that one of the fallout of that loss of resources is the inability to define even who the community that exists within our imagination, whose plight we might seek to imagine or consider, can be defined. If we don't even know that, then how does the act of imagination even occur?
Can I just add a footnote to that, Waleed?
Yeah.
Going back to the fuel excise, some economists have criticized it for not being appropriately targeted at those who need it most, say through, yep, you know, direct payments to those who fall below a particular income threshold.
Yeah.
But wasn't the purpose of a universal or universally applicable or indiscriminate fuel excise to take out the element of winners and losers?
Yeah.
Wasn't it an attempt to say, this is a moment of misfortune that is affecting everybody? Therefore, this aspect of the remedy will be applied to everybody, precisely so that the element of envy or resentment or mutual suspicion that might grow up when payments go to certain people and not others, so that, in other words, isn't that a kind of attempt to try to create a we who are undergoing a moment of hardship altogether?
Yes, but in practice, it doesn't work that way because some people drive more than others. I will now, as someone who doesn't drive, for example, have to bear the ongoing economic costs of this decision well past the period of immediate alleviation, etc. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, of course.
So I understand the symbolic nature of it. The economic argument doesn't engage with that because it's an economic argument, not a social one. Mm. But I see what you're saying. I just think that ultimately these things require something more deeply embedded than something that's expressed through a particular policy in response to a particular problem in a particular moment.
They need to appeal to something deeper, that's right.
Yes, that's right.
Melanie?
I think it's about how we cultivate shared sensibilities, that is, shared modes of perception, shared values, shared habits that can orient one to the precarity that is felt. I'm trying to avoid using the word we because I take your point, Waleed, that the we is always engaged in some kind of boundary. We, them, us, them, you know, etc. So, you know, how do we sidestep that? And I think that for me, at any rate, it's about what is the sensibility with which anyone enters the world? Is it one that is oriented toward the attunement of others and attentive to the potential for both their suffering and my own, or to be able to engage with one another in a field of kind of non-judgment where we can actually mutually support one another. And I suppose my response then would be to turn the lens in that direction to sort of sidestep some of the difficulties with the we, I, us, them kind of narrative.
I didn't mean to deprive you of all the pronouns, Melanie.
I know. You could see me. You could see me thinking, "Oh, which ones could I go for?"
I think it's a really important pronoun. It's complicated in the way that we've circumscribed it.
100%. And I think it's about what, you know, who is this we? Who occupies this imaginary? And, you know, what kind of presumptions are embedded within that claim to a we and to an us? And I think that that's a really, really important question.
And what happens when we don't share those presumptions?
Exactly. And I think that this comes back to, you know, that question of what it means to live under a liberal democracy where there is an attentiveness to the fact that not everyone will share those same presumptions. So how do you cultivate a sensibility of a kind of meaningful way of discussing and deliberating and engaging with others who, you know, might not share your worldview? And that's okay.
Melanie White, Professor of Sociology in the School of Social Sciences at the University of New South Wales, our guest for this week's edition of The Minefield, which is now at an end. Melanie, thank you.
A pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
And that is it from us this week. You can catch us again next week on ABC Radio National, of course, or anytime you like on ABC Listen. See you soon.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.